Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's a very elliptic morning. Steve really set up my talk quite nicely, and those of us who could not be in the Yucatan 2 weeks ago, we're just very sorry about that. So. But it's a real pleasure to be in Toronto. And so I'm going to talk about an issue that, at least today, has a few more questions than answers. But let me start with a story that is familiar to some, but probably not many of you. So let me give some background. So in Garnett's book, he proves the following theorem, which is based on some work of Varopoulos. And the theorem is the following. You have a bounded harmonic function in the upper half space. And then for any epsilon, you can find a C infinity function, phi, which is within epsilon of U, and which satisfies an L1 Carlson measure condition. Now, for bounded functions, indeed for BMO functions, this expression is Carlson, and so the novelty here is that this is the fact that this is an L1 condition. And this was of interest because if only you had this true for solutions U itself instead of this more cumbersome L2 condition, then various things would be easier to prove, Corona theorem, duality with BMO and the bidisk and so forth. Okay, so if a bounded harmonic function, if we have such a property for a given epsilon, we're going to say that the function is epsilon approximable. And as a corollary, Garnett draws the following, what he calls a local Fatou theorem. So n of epsilon is going to measure the oscillation of U on a line segment above a point x, in the sense that it's going to measure the number of times U oscillates by an amount epsilon. So we're going to fix an x on the boundary, and we're going to look at this line segment and measure the number of times the solution oscillates by epsilon. So the Fatou theorem says that n is bounded, but this is a local, this is a more quantitative version of that theorem. And this rescales, here I'm looking at at unit size intervals and oscillation on a line segment of unit length, but you can rescale this to other intervals. Okay. This theorem on being able to approximate bounded harmonic functions in the upper half space was extended by Dahlberg to harmonic functions in a Lipschitz domain. And the ingredients in this theorem of Dahlberg's was basically a stopping time argument. You collect the boxes where U has large oscillation, you already essentially have an L1 type estimate. And then what you do is you proceed to collect together the boxes where U has small oscillation, and you stop as soon as you get larger oscillation, and that region can be formed into a Lipschitz domain, and on this Lipschitz domain you have certain estimates. So I know that's all very vague, but the basic idea is this stopping time argument and the collection of these regions into Lipschitz domains on which you can use Lipschitz domain theory for harmonic functions. So in this paper with Koenig, Cook, and Toro, we took a look at this quantitative Fatou, and we thought in terms of A infinity being quantitative mutual absolute continuity, and we tried to look at this condition of epsilon approximability in terms of solvability of boundary value problems. So what we were interested in were divergence form operators, divergence A grad U, where the matrix A was elliptic and, in our case, real, but we're in a situation, we're motivated by studying boundary value problems in a situation where we don't have an L2 theory. So we don't get to jumpstart the theory by using some kind of L2 identity. So A infinity means that for the elliptic measure in this case, so we have a measure associated with the elliptic operator, and if it's A infinity, that means that this kernel satisfies an estimate that tells you that it belongs to some AP or some reverse Hölder class for some P. In other words, A infinity is equivalent to, by real variable theory, to the Dirichlet problem being solvable with boundary values in LP for some P, but it doesn't tell you what P. Okay, so here was a positive result of that paper. So you take a divergence form operator, elliptic, bounded measurable coefficients. Let's say it's real, so we do have the DiGiorgi-Nash-Moser theory. We can talk about solutions at points because we know that solutions are Hölder continuous of some order. An omega is a Lipschitz domain, and the theorem is that if all bounded solutions to L are epsilon approximable for every epsilon, in other words, they satisfy that L1 Carlson measure condition, then the elliptic measure belongs to A infinity, which then implies that we can solve the Dirichlet problem somewhere, but not necessarily in L2, and in fact, there are counterexamples to show that A infinity is the sharpest conclusion that you can draw here. Okay, but it's not exactly a readily checkable condition. So we took a harder look at this, and we considered what really were the main ingredients of Dahlberg's theorem that you could actually do this kind of approximation on for harmonic functions on Lipschitz domains. And so the main ingredient in Dahlberg's proof that is tied to something about the operator after you collect these regions of small oscillation into a Lipschitz domain is a condition that has to be satisfied for solutions, and the condition involves the usual characters in this field, so let me introduce those. Okay, so for a solution U to an operator in some domain, we take a boundary point Q and we form the non-tangential maximal function of U at the point Q. Now, the relationship between the non-tangential maximal function and the measure that I've been talking about, the elliptic measure associated with this operator, is that essentially this non-tangential maximal function is bounded by a maximal function of Hardy-Littlewood type formed with respect to the elliptic measure, where F is the boundary values of U. So that's the connection between an object like this and the measure. Also, we have another classical object, the square function, which we can form because all the quantities in here make sense, at least interpreted in L2 sense. And the classical relationship, that is for harmonic functions in the upper half space, the classical relationship between the non-tangential maximal function and the square function is that these are equivalent in LP for all P's between 0 and infinity. And the way you prove this, one of the ways to prove this is to first prove it in P equals 2 on a sufficiently large collection of domains so that then you can prove a good lambda inequality between the non-tangential maximal function and the square function. Okay, it was this equivalence, it was this fact that was used by Dahlberg in the stopping time argument. So you collect the ball, the regions together where you have small oscillation, it may go all the way down to the boundary. We form a Lipschitz, we soften the edges a little bit, we form a Lipschitz domain. Because we've stopped as soon as the oscillation is large, we have on this domain the fact that the non-tangential maximal function in this domain of the harmonic function is big. And you can compare that to the square function. Now, why is that a good thing to do? Because when we take the square function squared and we integrate it, we get something that looks very much like the expression there, which is the Carlson measure condition. Okay, so that's what we need to know. That's exactly what you need to know to prove epsilon approximability. So you have an operator, and you look at solutions to this operator in a domain, and you form the non-tangential maximal function and the square function, and you want to say if they're comparable in LP, then on a, and in fact this comparability has to be on all Lipschitz subdomains, because remember, we're going to run a stopping time argument, and we need to know this for certain domains that are formed from the stopping time argument. So on all Lipschitz subdomains, if bounded solutions are epsilon approximable, then the elliptic measure is in A infinity. Okay, so again, A infinity means that the Dirichlet problem is solvable in LP for some P. So first of all, and the second thing I'd like to note is that if you know that you have an operator for which A infinity holds for the elliptic measure, then the square function and the non-tangential maximal function are comparable on the on that domain. But you see, this is saying something stronger. You need more than the non-tangential maximal function and the square function on the domain itself. You need it on all Lipschitz subdomains. And that's not something that you can automatically say that you have true about your operator, because you know you can take you have an operator associated to a domain. You can arbitrarily change its coefficients up here to be as bad as you want. And you still have an operator which has the A infinity condition on the domain. Okay, let me give some applications of this theorem and or its proof. The first is this. Suppose that L is a divergence form operator whose coefficient, the matrix A, is real, and it's not necessarily symmetric. So that means we're out of the range where certain L2 identities, relic type identities, can be proven. But the coefficients of the matrix themselves satisfy some kind of regularity condition. And the regularity condition that's sharp here is that the distance times the gradient squared is itself a Carlson measure. So it says something. So again, I'm not saying that the gradient exists pointwise when applied to these coefficients. So this condition is rather loosely written. I should really write gradient of A as an average, L2 average, because I'm not imagining that my matrix of coefficients is actually C1. Okay, so I have this Carlson measure condition, and then the conclusion is that the elliptic measure is A infinity on omega. So how do you prove this? You prove this by verifying the conditions of the theorem. You take the non-tangential maximal function and the square function, and you prove that they are comparable in LP with respect to surface measure on every Lipschitz subdomain. Once you have it for some p, then you have it for all p by some real variable methods that apply in this case. So it suffices always to prove something like this for some p. Then as soon as you have this on all Lipschitz subdomains and for some p, then the good lambda inequality will give you this for all p. Okay. So that was sharp in the sense that if you just assume that the Carlson condition holds for these coefficients, namely that should I write that? I guess I should. Okay, so there's the condition that says that this is a Carlson measure, and if we just have this condition satisfied with some constant, then A infinity is the best we can conclude. However, if we assume in addition, which is the second result there, if we assume in addition that this constant goes to zero as the size of the cubes shrink, sort of an analog, the vanishing Carlson condition is the analog of VMO to BMO, then we can conclude that the Dirichlet problem is solvable for all p's bigger than 1. Also, the result in part 1 is true for non-divergence form operators as well, because there's a variant of this theorem which includes a lower order term. And the lower order term of this form means that anytime you have a non-divergence form operator, you can write it as a divergence form plus a lower order term, and the conditions are symmetric. So the existence of this lower order term gives you a theorem like this for non-divergence form operators as well. And I should point out that Christian Rios has some very nice work on non-divergence form case as well, with similar conditions, not exactly the same, and also other approaches that give A infinity, not this approach. I guess there's no slide 6. Okay. it's one of those highway signs. No exit 6. Okay. So the applications continued. So here's an application that Steve mentioned in his earlier talk. If L is a divergence form operator in R2, so this is very particular to R2 because we used a change of variable at some point that we just have no analog for in higher dimensions. And Steve was talking about some of the first real progress in the higher dimensional situation that you want to extend this theorem to higher dimensions, but it's not clear how. So you have a divergence form operator in R2 whose coefficients are independent of the transverse variable. Actually, amusingly enough, in this theorem, the coefficients of this operator can be independent of either variable, which is fairly bizarre, but I'm sure that can only happen in R2. then the elliptic measure is in A infinity, and that is a sharp result. And as Steve was mentioning, it's very natural to consider conditions on which the matrix is independent of the transverse variable, because you do need some kind of regularity in that transverse variable for Dirichlet problems to be solvable. And this case is sort of the base case. And it's also the case that Jerison and Koenig considered when they were first introducing this whole technique of relic identities into this theory. They showed that these relic identities held for real symmetric matrices when the matrix had coefficients that were independent of the x variable. The point is, you can just write down a divergence, an identity, a divergence identity, and integrate it. And the reason it's an identity is that you can pass a dt derivative through your matrix. Okay. So the counterexample that shows that the theorem is sharp is fairly simple. And the boundary value problem associated to this matrix turns out to be a sort of transmission problem in the upper half space. Okay. And then Koenig and Rule extended this to solve Neumann and regularity problems, again in R2, with data in LP for some value of P below bigger than 1 and less than or equal to 2. So the Neumann and regularity are in some senses that can be made precise, the dual of the Dirichlet problem. So if you can solve the Dirichlet problem for large P's, you're going to solve Neumann and regularity problems for small P's. Okay. So this is the statement of a Neumann problem. We take a Lipschitz domain solution in omega. We're now defining the conormal derivative to belong to LP, and we want an estimate on all derivatives in LP, and in fact an estimate on the non-tangential maximal function of the gradient. Okay, so I said that various of these results were applications of this theorem that says that if you can prove that non-tangential maximal functions and square functions are equivalent, a sort of classical estimate on these two operators, then you get A infinity. And there's two things about that point of view that I'd like to mention. One is you're never really going back to the boundary, right? You're saying that you have these two extensions. You have these two means of measuring aspects of your solution. You know, the non-tangential maximal function is, you're looking at the soup of pointwise values in a cone, and then the square function, you're looking at this other classical area integral identity. So you're looking at these two ways of measuring quantitatively extensions of U to the upper half space. And then you get a statement. From that, you get a statement about regularity of the elliptic measure. But how checkable is that condition? I mean, how do you actually verify that? Well, if you only need to verify this condition holding for some P, it's equivalent to check it for any P, then you're in luck when it comes to the square function, because the square function is the square root of this quantity, and you square it, and then you try to integrate it, and you can, and out comes an expression in the upper half space, in the upper half space, or in your Lipschitz domain, which has a term in it that looks like this and involves an integral that looks like this, and this would be the distance to the boundary, and the gradient squared is related to, you know, can be related to your equation, and so you have some hope of actually integrating that and dealing with that expression. But what about the non-tangential maximal function? How are you going to integrate that and get a hold of that? Okay, so this looks tractable, but how do you deal with the non-tangential maximal function? Well, the idea is that in some way that can be made precise, the non-tangential maximal function is, when you integrate the non-tangential maximal function, so you're taking the soup of the values of U in a cone, then that supremum will more or less be obtained on a Lipschitz graph that lies above this. And so integrating n squared of u down here is like integrating u squared on a Lipschitz graph above. But it's not exactly like that, but it's close enough. In other words, you can define this stopping time, which is very similar to the stopping time that appears in this classic paper of Pfefferman Stein. You define a stopping time which does the following. You know, you're looking for the soup of the values of u in a cone. So you take your cone and you bring it down from infinity and you stop the first time you hit a large value of u. And then that defines a function of x. So for every x in the boundary, you start your cone at infinity, you bring it down, you stop when the value of u is large, and that function of x is a Lipschitz function. And u will be big on big pieces of that Lipschitz function. And so that's what this idea really means. And so, in other words, if you can prove, there are two kings on the ceiling there, king and a jack. There's two cards up. I just looked up and okay. All right. So if you can prove a statement that says you can integrate u squared on all Lipschitz subgraphs and relate that back to the square function, then you can use a stopping time argument to get a hold of the non-tangential maximal function. So that's the basic idea, and that is why in principle this condition really is checkable, or more checkable than epsilon approximability. Better get out of the background here. Okay. So I'd like to return then to what is really still an imperfect correspondence between A infinity on the boundary and epsilon approximability and this condition. And by imperfect, I mean there's a number of questions that come out of this. First of all, we know we have this result that says if N is equivalent to S on all Lipschitz subdomains, then we get A infinity, but we only know that A infinity says something about our very boundary, not about things happening up here. It can't say something about things happening up here, because up here we might have an entirely different operator which does not have any A infinity properties with respect to a boundary up here. So all these conditions involve Carlson measures, or either specifically or in principle. So Martin Dindos and I started wondering about the connections between solvability and A infinity and being able to solve some kind of endpoint problem, in particular BMO. So as I said, there's more questions than answers, but we have a few things that we know. So here's a question. Suppose bounded solutions in a domain satisfy a Carlson condition. In other words, we can always essentially solve a boundary value problem in BMO. Are they always epsilon approximable? I mean, can you always approximate these arbitrarily well by C infinity functions which then satisfy an L1 type Carlson condition? That would then say that solving a boundary value problem like this in BMO could generate solvability in some LP. In other words, you could somehow perturb from BMO solvability to LP solvability for some P. And even better, is there some kind of T of one type theorem in this setting? Can you check on a particular subclass of BMO functions to get this solvability? Okay, so let me just be, as I said, there's more questions than answers, but let me tell you be specific about what we mean by solvability in BMO. Okay, so you have a solution to this operator with BMO data on the boundary, and now you'd like to be able to solve this with an equivalence of norms. So that's that equivalence of norms is what's going to generate somehow the connection between the solution and its boundary values. So first of all, you want to know that you get a Carlson measure, standard classical Carlson measure condition on solutions, that the distance times the gradient squared is in BMO. And you want to relate the norm, the constant that appears there, to the BMO norm of the function. Okay, so if you have A infinity, then you can solve it in BMO with equivalence of norms. And some parts of this theorem can be taken sort of directly from a proof of a similar theorem that Fabes and Neri did a long time ago for harmonic functions in Lipschitz domains. But it's the equivalence of norms is a trickier matter. Okay, so if you know that you have your elliptic measure belongs to A infinity and F is in BMO, then first of all, we'll see that this is a Carlson measure. Okay, as in the Fabes-Neri proof, you take a particular Carlson region and you're going to take your solution and split it into two pieces. There's a local piece and then there's a piece that's outside. And the local piece, you use the solvability of the Dirichlet problem in LP. And this gives an estimate for U1. And then, so the part U2, which is away from delta, has estimates that basically come on the kernel that basically come from the AP condition. So, for example, inside the box itself, U2 of x is less than decays as some distance to the boundary, and you can get a hold of this expression you can estimate this by a distance to the boundary, which is integrable, and this comes from the Helder continuity. And then as you go away from the box, you can get you get some decay on U2 from the AP condition. Okay, so it's not too hard to see that if you have solvability in some LP, then you have a Carlson condition. But the equivalence of norms is something else. Okay, so maybe I should say, right, okay, yeah, let me say this first. So in the case of the Fabes-Neri proof, so they proved this equivalence of norms and the solvability for harmonic functions in Lipschitz domains. So how did they get the equivalence of norms? They take an expression like, say, take your boundary data, F, and you look at an expression like this, which is the average of F minus its average squared. So you have an L2 norm on the boundary. And you form a new domain, the Carlson region, the Carlson domain above that. And this is equivalent to the L2 norm of F on this subdomain, right? And there, and now you have a new Lipschitz domain. And there you use the equivalence of L2 on F with the square function on F. And so when you put in the square function and you square it, you get an expression which involves the square function for the subdomain, so it involves distances to the boundary of the subdomain, but that's even smaller than the Carlson norm where you have distances to the boundary of D. So it's a matter of local solvability. Once you have this expression, you have local solvability on Lipschitz subdomains, then you can pass from here to the Carlson condition readily. Okay, so our problem is not that we don't have a condition our problem is not being away from L2. I mean, we have LP solvability for some P. Our problem is that we can't make this local transition here. Our problem is we can't say, oh, let's make a new domain, and now we'll just say something about the operator in this new domain, because we can't say anything about the operator in this new domain. We just have statements about the larger domain. So we have to do something. Okay, so we have to do something else. So we have to use the harmonic measure, and we have to pass back and forth from the harmonic measure, and we have to use a technique, a measure that came up in Dahlberg, Jerrison, and Koenig's paper when they proved that non-tangential maximal functions and square functions were always equivalent with respect to harmonic measure. They built a new measure in your domain. So we pass first back to harmonic measure, because BMO with respect to surface measure is the same as BMO with respect to harmonic measure if the two measures are A infinity with respect to one another. And then we can invoke a Carlson measure norm using a Green's function. And so now we can basically, it's a way of using the subdomain idea but introducing a new measure. And so the main idea is this construction of a sawtooth domain in Dahlberg, Jerrison, Koenig, which is still A infinity with respect to the other measure. And then we pass back to surface measure. Okay, so I can't really give details there, but just an idea. And now, from BMO to A infinity. So that's the less perfect part of this, and that's really what's mysterious here. BMO solvability with equivalence of norms does imply a good lambda inequality between the square function and the non-tangential maximal function on the domain itself. But it doesn't give it to you on every subdomain. So we do not know that solvability of BMO perturbs to solvability in some LP. So that's still a mystery. So we would, to conclude, in other words, we can prove a good lambda inequality like this, which, again, is not even so straightforward because you still have to get around the subdomain argument. But to conclude A infinity, you need that the equivalence of the square function, the non-tangential maximal function on all subdomains, which, again, is not something that... that we could even expect to prove. So using this methodology, we're not going to. Okay, so if you assume BMO solvability locally, so in other words, if you have an operator for which you know that the worst case is the boundary below, and you can actually and you do have local BMO solvability, not just on your boundary, but on every Lipschitz subdomain, then you can conclude A infinity. And the idea is that you can do this good lambda inequality and get an adaptation of local arguments to get this good lambda inequality. So the good lambda inequality for bounding the square function in terms of the non-tangential maximal function is a fairly straightforward application of arguments that we've seen before. So the way these good lambda inequalities work is the following. You decompose the set where the square function is big, you intersect it with places where the non-tangential maximal function is small, and the object is to show that those regions take up a smaller than a fixed fraction of your original domain. And then you add up the estimates at the end. The way that these things proceed is now on the bottom of your domain, you create a sawtooth domain and a new region where on this region your square function is big, but your non-tangential maximal function is bounded everywhere. And then you use the theory for that. Now, when you're working with the square function, as I said, this is a fairly straightforward argument because here you have the square function big, so you can simply integrate the square function in L2 and get an expression that looks like this. But when you're looking at the non-tangential maximal function bounded by the square function, then, as I said, you can't just start integrating non-tangential maximal functions and passing back to square functions. You have to introduce these subdomains in the stopping time argument and say that where the non-tangential maximal function is large down here, you have a subdomain up here where U is large, and so that you can make this whole argument work by passing to a subdomain. Okay, well, so I want to just end with this question of perturbation of BMO results, and perhaps one of you will help us solve this problem before the workshop ends. So, okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Any questions?
Yeah.
If I understood correctly, you very last bit, if you had a way of controlling the non-tangential max of, suppose you have BMO data, you had a way of controlling the non-tangential max in terms of the boundary data itself in some norm, some altitude. Would that then be enough to get? Is that the last thing you get? If you have that, would you then be able to get the probability of the square
function
measured
as
a maximum interior domain?
Well, so if you could immediately pass from the non-tangential maximal function to somehow the solution somewhere, then you're solving...
Well, but just with BMO data. It's not so... Right. If you had that with LP data, of course, that's equivalent to the harmonic measure being an infinity right away.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so there are various subtleties like that, right? So you could say, if you could just do this in BMO, then yes, this would go through. Another thing is you don't really need non-tangential maximal function square. You don't really need the full strength of non-tangential maximal function square function estimates on all Lipschitz subdomains. What you really need is you have a solution to your operator. Restrict it to a subdomain. Get the right estimates there, which is quite different from saying solve there and get estimates between the non-tangential maximal function and the square function. And if you look at the condition like epsilon approximability, that is a condition which restricts. You have something that's epsilon approximable on some domain. And of course, if you restrict it to a subdomain, it's still approximable. That doesn't mean that you get epsilon approximability on the subdomain, because you're not solving on the subdomain. So there is some subtlety there that we're trying to play with and see if we can understand better. So.
Any other questions?
Okay, thanks. We'll resume at 11:00.